This is our second to last week on the book of Ecclesiastes. And this morning, we're going to read the first six chapters, or the first six verses of chapter 11. So if you wouldn't mind turning there to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. It says this: ship your grain across the sea. After many days, you may receive a return. Invest in seven ventures, yes, in eight. You do not know what disaster may come upon the land. If clouds are full of water, they pour rain on the earth. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there it will lie. Whoever watches the wind will not plant, and whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Sow your seed in the morning and at evening, let your hands not be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. As we think about this passage this morning, it's important to remember that this is kind of just at the tail end of this book. And so as Solomon is beginning to kind of work towards closing the book of Ecclesiastes, we've discussed meaninglessness in life. We've discussed how there are certain things that are uncertain about life. We've discussed what's better or what's worse for us to invest in life. The teacher has told us the certain things that we should focus on all these days of our meaningless lives. It really, what we see is throughout much of the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is deconstructing the worldview of the reader. Solomon is taking the things about life that we think we know, the assumptions about life that we have, the things that we kind of take for granted about life, all of these sorts of things, the things that we orient our lives around, and he's deconstructing them. In lots of ways, it's like that process when a student will go to college in their first semester and they start to question kind of everything that they've learned or things that they've known. It's the process we go through in adulthood. It's kind of at these stages of life where we're in this new season and we begin to question about things that happened previously. That's a lot of what's going on here. Solomon is saying, you've been looking at the world in this kind of a lens, in this kind of manner, and he hasn't necessarily gotten into how we should look at it, but he's been kind of tearing down a lot of the things that people orient their lives around. He's pretty plainly said, if you think life is about money, you are wrong. If you think life is about having fun, you are wrong. If you think life is about work, you are wrong. If you think life is about accruing nice things, you are wrong. If you think that life is about wisdom and gaining wisdom, you are wrong. If you think anything about your life can be certain, you're kind of right. But the thing that you can be certain about is that at the end of your days under the sun, you'll be put in a box, you'll be buried, and you'll be quickly forgotten. That's what he says about life up to this point. Solomon has been deconstructing the way that many of us see the world. He's been bringing realities to light that are not present. This hasn't been a great source of inspirational teaching. But even while this isn't something that would be met with a great deal of fanfare, even by its original audience, by the hearers, that makes sense. We aren't comfortable when people begin to deconstruct and tear apart the way that we see the world, but this is an important book for us to read. If we think about the recipients of this work, of this book, it would have been people that were living fairly well at this time. The people that would have had the access, the people that would have understood it. So this is early on in the history of Israel when they were a nation. And so you had King David before Solomon, and David is remembered for all kinds of reasons as the greatest king of Israel. You know, but whenever God says David is a person after my own heart, that there's some pretty serious endorsement that takes place for David. But he's remembered as a great king because of the way that he's related to God. He's remembered as a great king because he successfully defended the country on so many occasions. He expanded expanded the territory of the country. He enriched the kingdom. The people kind of were in this process of going from sort of a ragtag group of tribes into becoming this organized kingdom of people. And a lot of that work happened under King David. And then Solomon comes along. And Solomon kind of picks up right where things left off. He constructs a beautiful temple to worship God. He constructs a beautiful palace for the kingdom that kind of elevates the status, not just of the king above his own people, but elevates the status of Israel and the king of Israel and of Solomon in the world. We've read passages that talk about the history of Solomon, that talk about how wise and brilliant he was, that talk about how wealthy he was compared to people that came before him, that talk about how he wasn't just wise. You know, a lot of us can think of a story or two, but how it says that people from kingdoms were sent and came from all over the world to meet with Solomon in Israel to learn from him, to take away from him. These were people, not all of them, but many of them, that would have heard this message in Ecclesiastes, that were enjoying the benefits of living in a kingdom where life was good, where the kingdom was on the rise. And yet, even in the midst of sort of this national, and we know that the kingdom splits after Solomon, but in the midst of this kind of national trend upward, he comes in and sort of brings all of that crashing down. And we all know people who are like this. We all know people that have a different way of seeing the world around us, and that sometimes have a way of seeing the world that sort of tears down the thoughts and conceptions that we have. Someone that's critiqueful. Someone that critiques a lot of the things that we say or do. Someone that even if it's uninvited, that they'll bring criticism to the way that you view the world. That they're always kind of pointing out the things that you see in the world, and they're kind of illuminating the fact that maybe you're not seeing the full picture. Maybe you're not understanding things correctly. Maybe you don't quite see things. And sometimes we invite that level of criticism and accountability, and that's one thing. But oftentimes we don't invite that. And we don't really want those kind of people around. We don't really want to receive those words. I imagine that as Solomon is tearing down the worldview of the people in that time, much like the way we're kind of we'd naturally receive the book today, that there's a lot of pushback that happens in that process. You know, when we invite someone over to our house for dinner, we want them to tell us how nice the maple bacon crumble is on top of the brie. We don't want them to look at the pictures, the portraits on the wall, and say, those must have been really expensive pictures of your family. That was dumb. You're all going to be dead someday and buried in a box and forgotten. We don't invite people to give us that kind of perspective on life very often. We don't invite people to illuminate those kinds of things about life. And so in this respect, Ecclesiastes as a book is a hard pill to swallow throughout much of the writing, but it's one that we need to hear. Because what's really taking place throughout this book is that Solomon is alerting people to the reality that we oftentimes live just from the advantage, from the vantage point of the present. That oftentimes in life, we only consider our circumstances under the sun. And we focus in and we advise people oftentimes to kind of live in the present. You know, we print it on whimsical t-shirts. We think about it when we're on vacation and we try to put our phone down and not check emails from work. We oftentimes have this focus on how important it is to live in the present. But throughout much of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is kind of challenging that vantage point and saying there's a better way, a more important way to look at life than just taking everything right in the present. Because there are negative consequences to only living in the present. When we get up in the morning and we immediately feel the stress of work, and maybe it's on a day where you have a big presentation or, you know, changes are being unrolled. Maybe it's just that you wake up and you know there's no way you're going to get done everything you need to get done in a day. We should step back, and Solomon would say we need to kind of view life with a big picture. But we need to see things from a different vantage point. When our kid does something that makes us angry, instead of getting caught up in that exact moment of anger, it's wise for us to step back and kind of look at the big picture in life. When we look at Facebook and Instagram or any other kind of social media, and we see that everyone else is living a perfect life with a perfect family and a perfect house and going on perfect vacations, and we see that kind of an image, we can start to obsess over how we can have a more perfect family or a more perfect life. And we need to step back sometimes and remember that that's fake. And then also view life from a bigger picture. View life from a different vantage point. And there are a few things in this second to last chapter of Ecclesiastes that will help in some ways to reinforce and expand on other things that Solomon has been writing about throughout this book. But really, what it does is helps to illuminate to us that sometimes we need a different way of looking at the world around us. And one of the things that Solomon focuses on in these six verses is that there are certain things about life that we need to accept that are uncertainties. We see a couple of these things in our passage today. And so we're going to read again from Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. It says this: "Ship your grain across the sea. After many days, you may receive a return. Invest in 7 ventures, yes, in 8. You do not know what disaster may come upon the land." And in these verses, we see that we cannot know exactly what will happen in the future. We all know this, but we don't like to think about it. We all know that there's a level of control that we don't have, but we don't like to acknowledge that. That the future is not promised to any of us. In the first illustration in that passage is a little bit cryptic, kind of that idea of shipping our grain across the sea. And in some translations that are even more cryptic that you're reading might say something about casting your bread upon the water and about the idea of receiving a return from that. And this isn't about feeding ducks at a lake. It's referring to this idea of making an investment of our resources up front with the intention, but not the promise, of receiving a good return in the end. That idea is more apparent in verse 2. The passage instructs that we hear from, you know, investment advisors, from stockbrokers, from people all the time, that we need to have a diversified portfolio, that we need to invest in different options because we can't be certain that one option is going to succeed or what could fall, what could befall that option, what will happen in the future. And so we shouldn't put all our eggs in one basket, because if we do that, the bottom of the basket might fall out and we might be left without any eggs. Some people will use a passage like that to say they will not invest at all. Some people will use a passage like that to say, I'm just going to hold on to what I have, that I'll just play it safe. But that's not what Solomon says here. He instructs that we should be wise in our investing because we cannot predict what will happen in the future. We can see another thing we don't know in verse 5. It says, "As you do not know the path of the wind, or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things." Pretty obvious. We cannot understand the work of God. We learn that this is the work of God, the way that God does things, is one of the uncertainties that we experience in life. So often we ask the question, why God? Just a few weeks ago, we looked at the story of Job and how when there were things going on in Job's life and he wasn't able to control them, he wasn't able to fix them, he wasn't able to understand what God was doing, that he began to levy these accusations against God, that he began to kind of stack up these complaints that he had or these questions that we had. And that's natural. That's a natural response for all of us. We want to understand the work of God. We want to know why bad things happen to good people. We want to be able to give people the answers to the questions they have. Sometimes it's about the state of our world. Sometimes it's about how a good and perfect and loving God could allow a specific bad event to happen in someone's life. Sometimes it's about how there's this appearance that the unrighteous, that the wicked can prosper in all of these different areas and avenues and venues of life, but that the righteous just struggle. We want to know how God works, but we can't. Oftentimes. Solomon illustrates, he teaches us, he points out how it's impossible for us to fathom how God orchestrates life, how he provides, how he teaches us through difficult moments, how he strengthens us, sometimes in good seasons of life and sometimes in the midst of hardship, how he allows what appears like the seemingly righteous to suffer while the seemingly wicked go unpunished. Solomon teaches us that the reason, one of the reasons we can't understand the work of God, that we can't understand why things happen the way they happen, is because we are not God. Because we have a vantage point of this life that is in the present, that is here and now. That we don't have the understanding he has from the beginning of time. That we don't have the foresight that he has. That we have an understanding that is temporal and present here and now. And God has a perspective that is eternal. And that encompasses all of life and not just our individual lives. The Apostle Paul shares kind of a similar message about our understanding of the work of God in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 12, when he wrote, "For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." Solomon says bluntly that we cannot know how God works because we only have the advantage point of being under the sun. Paul says a bit more hopefully that even though things now, even though we don't get the full picture now, even though it seems like kind of a dim picture and we're not always able to grasp it in particular, that it won't always be this way. Solomon teaches us that despite our efforts and our great frustration, we cannot understand the way God works under the sun. And then in verse 6, there's one last piece of uncertainty about life that we need to consider. It says, "Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let your hands not be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well." And this is kind of similar to the first point, but this final point teaches us that we cannot guarantee success. In the same way that we cannot predict the future, in the same way that we cannot control the future, we cannot guarantee that all of our ventures in life will be successful. There's an 18th century poem called "To a Mouse" by Robert Burns. And he tells this story of a mouse in this poem. And so the way this poem works is that he's telling the story really about the life of a mouse and a field mouse. And he says that if a field mouse goes and sets up his nest and builds his home right in the midst of a farmer's field, thinking of like a cornfield that we have plenty of here, that when that mouse builds its nest in a cornfield, that it is living high off the hog. That mouse is surrounded by an abundant source of food. That mouse is experiencing the provision. That it has chosen to build its house in a location where it will be well taken care of. And then the poem goes on to say, how sad of a day will it be for that mouse when he wakes up and finds that the farmer has harvested the corn. That all of a sudden he had positioned himself well in life, and all of a sudden his source of food is gone. And then it goes on to say that how much sadder will it be for that mouse when the next spring, when the farmer comes back and plows the field and runs the blade of the plow through his nest that he spent this time constructing in the field. And so you have this idea that this mouse built its house in a good location, where it would be provided for abundantly and taken care of. and through circumstances outside of its own, it was unsuccessful. It could not guarantee success. And near the end of that poem, there's a line that many of us know in modern English. It says, "The best laid schemes of mice and men go oft awry and leave us only grief and pain for promised joy." And when Robert Burns wrote that, this kind of poem to a mouse, this letter to a mouse, he ends that not by kind of commiserating with the mouse, but saying, "Hey, you have it pretty good." Because when you're a mouse, you only respond to that kind of the problems that happen in the immediate. But for us, when we think about failures in life, when we think about how our best laid schemes often go awry, we have the past that we can remember our failures. We have the fear of the failures in our future. And we have the state of mind to recognize that the things that we invest in now might not be successful for us. And so in a sense, what Robert Burns is saying is that the mouse has it pretty nice at the end of the day, that it only responds. But what this passage teaches us is that we need to consider the things that we cannot know. We need to live in a way where we recognize that not everything we're involved in will likely be successful, and we certainly can't guarantee the success of it. And then at the same time, it teaches us something that we should know about life, a vantage point that we should endorse about life. And there's just one of these. But in these six verses, what we see, one of the things that we see, is that we should not hold on to our lives too tightly. That we shouldn't hold on to things in an unhealthy kind of fashion. And by lives, I mean on one hand, the things that we earn, our material possessions, our investments. That was a sort of a theme of those six verses. But we see it in a kind of a greater sense that this isn't just about our money or our stuff, that this is about our very lives. That we shouldn't hold on to our lives too tightly. To re-explore verses 1 and 2, we won't read them again, but the passage where it talks about, you know, shipping your grain across the sea, that idea of sending something out and not knowing exactly about the investment and not being able to predict the future. There's some of us that read a passage like that, and we become paralyzed by the fear or the risk of loss. There are some of us that live our lives, in a sense, where we're paralyzed and we become indecisive and we can't make a decision because we have this fear of loss. We want to play the safe card every time because we think that what we have now is better off than losing what we may have in the future. In the example here, you know, it seems to be specifically talking about investment or kind of gaining capital, but the idea is something that's applicable across all of life. We should not live with kind of a deficiency mindset, that we need to hold on tightly to everything because we are afraid that maybe we'll lose things that are important to us in life. This is what we see in the parable of the talents in Matthew chapter 25. We aren't going to read that, but many of us know that story, how there were three servants, and as the king's going away, he gives one of them five bags of gold, and the servant turns it into another five bags of gold as he invests it. He gives one two bags of gold, and he turns it into two bags of gold, and he gives one bag of gold, and that person doesn't invest it, or doesn't gain anything, or doesn't lose anything. He buries it in the ground. Because he wants to make sure he doesn't lose what he has. The first two servants are praised for the way that they returned the master's money and gave him in advance. And the third is called wicked. We also see this idea in the parable of the rich fool in Luke 12. In this parable, Jesus is solving a dispute where there are brothers that are kind of fighting over inheritance. And one brother comes to Jesus and says, "Can you instruct my brother that he needs to give me my fair share of the inheritance?" And Jesus tells this story of a rich man that yielded, you know, was a farmer in this agrarian culture. And this rich man yielded an especially large crop. And he got so much during the harvest season that he filled up his storehouses. And so he's kind of figuring out what to do because his storehouses are full. And he says, I'm going to tear down these storehouses. I'm going to build bigger storehouses. And then I'm going to kind of take it easy in life. I'm going to relax. I'm going to just live off of this surplus that I've accumulated. And then in the parable, it says, but that night God demanded his life of him, that he passed away, that his abundant crop was of no use to him, that his wealth was of no use to him, that there wasn't any guarantee that he'd be able to hold on to it. And Jesus concludes that parable by saying, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. Solomon teaches us not to hold on to our possessions for fear of losing them. In Matthew, he doesn't teach us to be unwise, but he teaches us not to hold on to them too tightly. In Matthew, Jesus teaches us not to waste opportunities for fear of failure. In Luke, Jesus teaches us not only to not hold on to our possessions so tightly, but to be rich towards God, to be people that are generous. And again, not just with finances, but with our lives. And Jesus deepens this concept even further in the way he instructs us to consider more than just our money, but our lives, as he writes in Mark chapter 8, verses 34 and 35. It says, then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. Jesus makes it clear that we should not be afraid to let go of things simply for fear of losing them. And when it comes to our lives, he explains that it's actually in losing our life, in giving our life, that we keep them. It's not just a message about money or talents or possessions, it's about our very being. And of course, this isn't just something that Jesus told his disciples, told his followers, that they ought to do, but it is something that he modeled. And when it says in Mark 8 that we need to follow him, it isn't just saying that we need to follow his example of graciousness or generosity. It isn't just saying that we need to be people that live wisely and that give to others. It isn't just saying that we need to be people that follow the wisdom that we're instructed to in Ecclesiastes. It doesn't just say we need to follow him. It says that we need to take up our cross and follow Jesus. That we need to be people that are continuously in life seeking to take up our cross and to follow Christ. This act of taking up our cross and following Jesus is something that Paul explains for us in Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, as he says, I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. And when Paul writes these words, this kind of strange, the context of this passage is that Paul isn't really writing about a life of faith. It describes that. It gives that context. But really, when Paul's writing this in Galatians, the big message that he's trying to communicate in this book is the sufficiency of Jesus for all of life. That when we have been crucified with Christ, and when we no longer live, that we have experienced everything that we need to experience, that we have everything that we need to have. There was the temptation that was present then and is still present for us now, that we kind of add the good news plus stipulations that we put in about what it means to follow Jesus. And in this passage, Paul is saying to us that we have life through Christ because he is sufficient to provide everything that we need for fullness of life here in the present and for all of eternity. So Solomon teaches us that we hold a kind of a tenuous relationship with this world, and that oftentimes we need to be people in life that don't just live and react to problems and focus in on what we need in the immediate moment or in the present, but that we need to be people that adjust our vantage point and step back and look at the big picture. And for us, as people that claim the name of Christ, we step back and we look at the big picture, whether it's in moments of stress at work, in moments of concern over our physical needs, in turmoil in relationships. We step back and we look at the picture and we recognize that Jesus is sufficient to meet all of our needs in life. That with all of the uncertainty that we experience about not being able to control our future, control our present, that we can't guarantee success, that we can't always understand the way that God works or the reason why God does certain things, that we can step back and say Jesus is sufficient for all of life. That Jesus is sufficient to take care of all of our needs. So I want us to ask the question, do we orient our lives around things that are fleeting, things that Solomon might call meaningless? Do we live in fear of what we might lose? Do we live in fear of failure? Or do we live with the recognition that Jesus is our certainty, that he is our hope, that he is our life, and that he is sufficient?